Good morning. Any questions from yesterday? So we started to look at GR. So today we continue with that and we start moving towards the black holes. So the first goal of the day is to understand this covariant Hamiltonian flow equation for general relativity. So let's remember we had as a Lagrangian, 1/2 Ricci curvature minus lambda, the cosmological constant, times the volume element. And from these, it's an exercise that probably you've done plenty of times. We get that the equations of motion are 1/2 GAB plus lambda GAB times GAB. And again, this is the variation of the metric with the indices up. It's not the variation of the inverse metric, just in case. It's not super important to follow the lectures, but it's a good reminder to know that there can be this confusion. In the symplectic covariant symplectic potential current is the gradient of the variation of the metric minus the divergence of the variation of the metric minus the gradient of the trace of the variation of the metric. An important point about these symbols, I don't know if I've used them much, I don't remember. So let's revisit them for a second. So this is the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric times the top form. And this epsilon A is, in fact, the contraction. So this might look a little bit confusing maybe, but so this is the contraction of the volume element with the vector pointing in the direction A. This is useful because if we have an expression like the integral over sigma, which is a codimension one surface, so you cannot, so this is the volume element on M. On sigma, we need to go down one dimension. So and we have something like a vector contracted with epsilon A like this. Then this becomes, this becomes the integral of the normal component of this vector with the right metric, the induced metric on the boundary. And the other useful identity is something like the following. We have that is about Stokes' theorem. So you, typically, these things come from integral in the bulk of divergences, let's say, of this. And this will read, this is deep in the bulk, we will have that this is D of the associated form. So you can go from one to the other by Hodge dualization, and this already takes into account that change. Okay, so, and this is also equal to the integral over sigma of the associated d minus 1 form. Okay? So it's a, you can put j here in all the slots, and you get an idea of what's going on. But this is true for anything. Okay, as long as this is a top minus one form or a vector or a one vector field. Okay, so now we have theta, we have L, so what do? We compute the Noether current. And to compute the Noether current, I need to make a small parenthesis about general covariance. So, I should have. And another way general covariance is often referred to is background independence. So what does this mean? This is a statement about, let me write it for L, and then I will generalize it. So it's easier to write it first and then to discuss its meaning. So what does this mean? This means that if we take the field space variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the action of diffeomorphisms in field space. So yesterday we discussed that these diffeomorphisms act, rho xi is the action of diffeomorphism meant as changes in the metric, is exactly equal to the change in the Lagrangian along a usual diffeomorphism, like a diffeomorphism is the lead derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to that vector field, to the corresponding vector field. Okay. So this seems trivial, but it contains a lot of information. The reason is that this means in particular that L does not contain any background structure in the sense that suppose I have a, okay, it's easier to see what goes wrong in an example where this does not happen. So suppose a scalar field on a background. If I have background spacetime. So in this case, my Lagrangian is a function of my scalar field phi, and will look like square root of g, maybe 1/2, square root of g, nabla phi, a nabla phi, a. Or let even more explicitly, so that there's no doubt about what's going on, dA phi, dB phi. Okay, so with this Lagrangian, if my field space is just given by phi and the metric is just there as a background structure, is some scalar field on a fixed spacetime, I can write this in any coordinate I like. That's not the point. The point is g is not part of field space. So if I take the lead derivative of xi of this L, of the scalar field, this will not be the lead derivative of this Lagrangian. Why? Because this acts only on phi and not on g. So this means that to have an equality like this, it means that any object entering the Lagrangian must be part of field space. So it means that every structure in L is dynamical,
if that's another way of putting it.
So this innocent looking equation, in fact, contains a lot. So this will be true not just for L, but for any of these objects, as long because they are, So in particular, it will hold for theta, which will be important later. So just to emphasize this once more, these we can give a definition. Alpha is a form on M cross F, is general covariant, if and only if L rho psi of alpha is equal to L psi alpha. And as what I want to emphasize is that this is acting on F, and this is essentially acting on M. So this is an operation I do on the form part of M of alpha on M, and this is on the form part of alpha on field space. I hope that makes sense. So here in this specific case, this is a form just on M, but in general, the lead derivative makes sense also on theta and so on. That's what I mean.
But if you go to higher codimensions, then because of the normal vector, this will not necessarily.
No. So that's why I'm doing it on forms. On forms, there is no ambiguity. So here, there's no. You don't have to think about N, which indeed can be confusing. So there, this requires also knowing something about sigma, and how you choose sigma, and so on. Whereas with forms, there's on M, there's that problem does not arise. Yes.
Do you have like a physical interpretation for this equality?
Well, the physical interpretation is that every object entering this functional is, it means two things. It means first that my theory is written in a geometric fashion so that the right-hand side can make sense. So here I need to write it in terms of generic metric. If I write it in Cartesian coordinates, well, it's a bit harder to see. This would still make sense, but it would be a bit harder to access because I wouldn't see G and stuff like this. So I first have to write it in a way which is completely geometrical for the right-hand side to make sense over space-time. But then it also tells me that even though this can be a totally fine coordinate-independent Lagrangian over, well, maybe I should put d4x, over my space-time, not all the fields are dynamical in this, because I'm not varying G. I'm just looking at the scalar field on a fixed geometry. So this cannot hold, because this will act only on the dynamical variables appearing in field space. If G is a background structure, like here, then it will not hold. So it's a bit easier to say what it means when this doesn't hold. It means that there is something kept fixed as a background. And then it's called as a background in that sense, because it's fixed there and things move on top of it.
You said that you don't include the normal vector, but that's by choice. Like, if you take the whole object that you're integrating, in that information there is a background. You just separate out the part that doesn't have a background. It's choosing a foliation.
This theta does not depend on the foliation. Do you agree with this?
But epsilon A is like the normal vector times the
one sigma. No, these equality is true for any choice of sigma. And n will be adapted to sigma, but this is
it's only when you pull it back.
This is not the pullback of exactly. You get n when you pull it, when you pull these things back to the surface. If you can have a top minus one form on spacetime, and that does not know anything about any sigma. It's just a top minus one form sitting on spacetime.
But it's only background dependent when you pull it back to sigma.
Well, then there is a choice of sigma that enters, and it's your job to be very careful about what you mean by when you do that. Is sigma chosen in? Well, it's a very subtle question at that point, how you choose sigma. And we could discuss for an hour only about this. So maybe, but if you choose it in, yeah, the only thing I can say is that if you choose sigma relationally, it might make sense to have it field, it would mean that it's field dependent. It depends, you choose a sigma based on the configuration you have. But this is a tricky thing to do in practice. But conceptually, you might say, oh, I put my sigma aligned with is where my scalar field phi takes value 3. And so this is associated to a given configuration. And so at that point, is field dependent. And so it will be dynamical in its own way. Whereas if I say, well, this is where my coordinate z takes value 3, then you are playing a different game. But okay, so we'll leave it at that. So, but the important point is that these problems do not arise when I look at theta, for example, because this is defined independently of any choice of sigma. Okay, this was a very good point, which causes indeed a lot of confusions and problems when doing quantum gravity. So now we can go back to the Noether current. And remember that the Noether current is defined as the contraction of theta with the symmetry minus this leftover piece, which is the the boundary terms as comes out when I vary my Lagrangian by a symmetry, and so we have theta. We need to compute r, but r we can compute it easily thanks to this formula. Background independence tells us that d r xi is equal to l xi l. And this has two pieces a priori. But in fact, we will see that this piece is not there because this is already a top form. So d of a top form is identically 0. And so what we find is that we can take r to be simply the contraction of L with xi, which is a vector. So this all makes sense. We can, so another way of writing it using those formulas, just to play around with, there is R and the Ricci. Well, the Ricci, you will recognize when it's the Ricci because it appears in the Eisner's equation, but close to. Well, I don't think it would create confusion, but I'm sorry if it does. So if we contract psi with epsilon, we get psi A contracting with epsilon A. And so with this, we can compute, we can compute J. Oh, the other, of course, the other piece of information we need to do it is that is delta xi GAB. So to understand what is the, well, let me write it in two steps. What is this object, of course, GAB? This is, by definition, the variation of G by the diffeomorphisms. And as we know, this is dA, this is the lead derivative of the metric, which is also this object here. So how does one proceed? One plugs in this formula in there, and I will write the result. Plug in, and we get there's just a second. I'm a bit confused by one quick thing. I hope there's some weird norm. Okay, here we go. We obtain let me write it as C, AB, Xi B, plus DB, JBA of Xi. So remember, this is the piece that by Noether, by the analysis we did yesterday, should vanish on shell. Is a, as we will see immediately, these are essentially just the, well, these are just the equations of motion, in fact. So this is equal CAB. Well, I should have called it simply, let me check the normalizations. Well, this CAB is just minus, I'm a bit confused by the factors of two, but I suppose I will trust what I wrote here. So as we can see, this is the equations of motion, which vanish on shell. And from this, we can also deduce the constraint. If you remember, the constraints were this guy written on the surface. So in this case, it's just NA CAB. So this is my constraints. But the difference is, of course, small. It's just because we will see better in the last part of the course why we want to call these the constraints just on the surface sigma. It's about the canonical analysis. So this is more of a note for later. And finally, the other important thing is this JBA, which is anti-symmetric. And is so the important, it's anti-symmetric. It's important because it makes it automatically conserved, right? So if I take the divergence of this, I will get identically zero, which is exactly, it is the tensorial way of writing that J is equal to 6i plus D of a codimension 2 form, top minus 2 form. So this is the same thing that we wrote last time as yeah. So This object is called the Comer current. Comer current. A slick way of writing it, which you might encounter, is -1/2 star d of Cg, where by Cg I mean GAB is the one form associated to that vector. Of course, diffeomorphisms are vectors, not forms. But using the metric, I can pull down the index and define a one form. And this is the associated two form. And this is a top minus two form, which is G, which is this JAB now up to signs. This is also, which I will try to fix in the notes. It's also, you can also write it like this, where AB is the double contraction of those epsilon with two directions. So in this sense, if this is antisymmetric, everything, one can think of it as a top minus two form. So everything is consistent with what we saw yesterday. Good. So we have, this is a bit of, it's not too long of a computation. You can imagine how it works. You want the curvature to pop up, to come out. So you will plug in this expression in theta. You have this covariant derivatives, it's in twice on xi. You commute them appropriately. Some curvature, some Riemann will pop out, will be contracted among themselves, and will give you some Ricci curvature, which will combine to give GAB. Where does this other term come from, and the Ricci scalar? Well, this guy comes from R, which is given by the Ricci scalar and the cosmological constant. So it makes sense that they will combine and give you. So this lambda will come specifically from that piece. So it's not too long of a computation. It's an exercise that you can do. So again, this vanishes is not a surprise. It's the general feature for local symmetries. The other piece which is important is this Comer current. Okay. So now we can plug this in our other theorem, which is the one that gives us the flow. What is the what is the fate of this? So remember, we had these results. If I put my, yes. The signs are right. There is a bit of a. There is a sign instability in the between my my notes. Okay, so this equation we found it a couple of lectures ago. It's nothing fancy. You just write these, you can think of starting from this expression. You write it using Cartan's formula, and you get one term that looks like this guy, one term that looks like d of I theta, I rho theta. Then to get j, you have to add and subtract this. So it's really nothing fancy. This is a simple identity that you can resolve by plugging in the definition of j and writing this using Cartan's formula. But the interest now is that we can figure out whether this is zero or not. So. And look, there is something also also interesting. We will be interested in this for GR, but in fact this result holds for any general covariant theory and diffeomorphic symmetries. So we had, remember, we just computed that R xi is I xi of the Lagrangian. So we know what to put here. So we get d R xi is equal to I xi of dl, which we know to be I xi of E plus I xi of d theta, right? Here I'm just using general covariance, which is giving me this formula. And the other formula where I can use general covariance is the one for theta. And this will not be just, now I have both terms. One term is I xi theta, and the other term is I xi d theta. And we see that this term combines with that, and they drop, but everything else survives. So we get we do not get zero. We always get some leftover for diffeomorphism. Now, we want to understand better what these two pieces are. So to do it, it is convenient to integrate over a sigma. So here we get our Comer charge. So this is, I'm rushing ahead. So we get our charge, the Noether charge, plus the integral of I xi e over sigma, plus the integral on the boundary of I xi theta. So this first term vanishes on shell, of course. So this, we have two obstruction number one and obstruction number two. Let's look at them independently. So obstruction number one, it's an off-shell obstruction. So off-shell obstructions can be annoying, but they are not severe in the sense that it means they mean that we need to off-shell analyses are way easier because you remember to get the symplectic structure on shell for the covariant phase space. We discussed this yesterday. We go on shell and we find that on shell of a gauge symmetry, the omega sigma is degenerate, because what happens? If we have a Cauchy surface, this will not be there. Well, this will not be there, but also Q will vanish. And so omega sigma will be degenerate on shell. So it means that we need to quotient stuff. And then we will find it's a more complicated space to work with. So working off shell allows us to have a phase space description, which is much simpler. But the problem is that we do not get a complete, well, diffeomorphies are not Hamiltonian symmetries in the usual way. They're not Hamiltonian symmetries of shell. In particular, which diffeomorphies give us troubles? So let's try to understand this guy a little better. So we wrote E in that form is just the only form part is epsilon. So once we pick a foliation, so we can talk about an off-shell phase space associated to sigma, we get that this is equal to our it's equal to something times I xi epsilon. So what is this? This is, again, sigma something xi a epsilon a. Can you tell me which of the components of sigma, of xi, contributes to this equation? Well, what I mean, or better, are there components of xi that would not contribute to this term? So there are two types of components of xi that are interesting to look at, those tangent to sigma and those transverse to sigma. So what happens for the tangent ones? They vanish. And why they vanish? Well, let's do this in coordinates, for example. So let's say, so the claim, let me just say the result. Here, this is equal to, and then we'll see why this is the case. Xi n, well, in fact, is due to this expression here. So it's just the normal component of that contributes. So this is xi n. Okay. So it's due to that formula. So in coordinates, it's easy to see. So in adapted coordinates, sigma, let's say, is the surface t equals 0, then epsilon a will be, this will be, what do I want to write? Xi a epsilon a will be xi 1 wedge, sorry, xi 0 dx 1 wedge dx n minus 1 plus xi 1 dx 0 dx 2 dx 3, etc., plus xi 2 dx 0 dx 1 dx 3, etc., and so on. Why? Because when I have xi naught is contracting with x0, which is dt, gives me 1, and so on and so forth. So
Psi is psi 0 d0 plus psi 1 d1 plus etc. So when I pull back to sigma, this expression, the only one that survives, all of these have dt equal, well, have dx appearing. So they give 0. So this is d naught dxn minus 1 plus stuff that is the pullback of dx0 to sigma, which which is identically 0, because x naught is kept constant. Well, here any value would work, OK? So this is the simple way to see it. More abstractly, one gets a formula like this. So only an obstruction. And this gives me a problem only for diffuse, transverse diffuse. And if you remember, this was the same thing that was happening when we were looking at translations over a Minkowski background, for example, for a scalar field, like a situation like this where we had Killing symmetries for the background, so let's say Poincaré transformations, and we picked we were getting the same type of result. So in that case, we were getting that time translation symmetry on a surface like this would not be Hamiltonian of shell, and there would be precisely this would be proportional to the equations of motion. So it had the same structure. Yes.
Should expression 1 have a minus sign?
Yeah, there might be a minus that I missed. This one. Yeah. Okay. So we expect in an off-shell Hamiltonian analysis of gravity that diffuse in the time direction will behave differently. So this is what gives you the Hamiltonian constraint and the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and it's related also to the problem of time that we analyzed in the toy model of the parameterized particle. So this is a very, although here it comes out quite kind of innocently and it looks a bit harmless because, oh, it's just a non-shell, an off-shell problem. Well, the point is that usually when you start quantizing things, you first quantize them off-shell and then you impose the constraint later. But here you see that this is kind of creating some kind of troubles. But and in particular, this is telling you that, well, OK, there is more to this story that hopefully we'll discuss next week. But this is the beginning. The second obstruction on the other hand, that is not about being on or off shell, is about corner. About so, in a similar fashion as psi in on sigma, that, like the first term only was non-zero only if psi has a transverse component to my surface. In the second case, what one finds is that I xi of theta will be there only if
Xi is
non-zero only if Xi is transverse to partial sigma.
So the reasoning is precisely the same. So what is the picture here? The picture here, you can imagine to have your region sigma, and you have its causal domain. So these famous, right, these famous diamonds. And here you have the corner. Now, we have seen that, maybe the 3D drawing is more confusing than anything. So let's do it 2D. So this is our sigma. These two points here represent the boundary. So we have seen that problem one arises when we want to move our surface like this. And problem two arises when we want to move our surface like that. So this, we can see that is something about actually moving the cone itself. Because if we move the corner, we are actually changing the causal domain. Now, this is a picture. So of course, here we are talking about variations of the metric, not of the surface itself a priori. But of course, general covariance kind of relates the two. So we can, as a picture, we can see that, morally speaking, if our diffeos act as if they were moving the corner, then we would run into troubles. The reason why this is not unexpected, and it's a problem also on shell, is because we are actually changing the region we're looking at. And by doing so, we are including or excluding degrees of freedom. So this doesn't need to point outwards. It can also point inwards, of course. So by changing the domain, we are changing the on-shell, the off-shell for sure, but even the on-shell degrees of freedom that we are including, because there is things here that is impossible to encode on that surface or even in this whole region. Whereas for the red type of diffeos, the type 1 diffeos that vanish at the corner, what is going on is that the dynamics helps me to relate what is happening on this surface and on that surface. I just apply some time evolution, and now I can relate them, so everything kind of can work. From the symplectic picture, but not in the purple case. This is the intuition behind these two different obstructions, and why one, you can expect it to give problems only off-shell. It's like time translation in the case of the scalar field. It's not too different, after all. Whereas it's quite different what is going on at the corners there. So working on shell will take care of problem one, and we can be sure to have at this level in the covariant phase space, you want to work on shell anyway. If you have to deal with problem two, then one has to be a little careful. So in the case we will analyze, the black hole case, what will happen is the following. In some cases, I might be able to impose strong enough whatever this means, boundary conditions at sigma, or maybe at the entire, and therefore, in a sense, on the entire boundary of the cone. But since we're working, what we care really about in this analysis is just one sigma, so he's more at Barton sigma, such that the integral of this form. So remember, this is a priori a one form on F. But maybe we can impose conditions such that this becomes the integral of something of some zero form on F. Top is a top zero form on partial sigma F. So what does it mean to impose boundary conditions from our field space perspective? It means that if we restrict the field space we're looking at enough, maybe pulling back this thing onto that subspace of field space gives us a form that is exact. So imposing boundary conditions means considering some F boundary. And maybe we are also interesting to do it only on shell. So, but the on shell is, I just put bars if you want on top. And pulling back. To this subset of configurations. So this is a possible picture, and this is what will happen in the case of black holes that we will look at. So black holes are, we will be interested in black holes in asymptotically flat spacetime with certain properties. And so if we restrict our attention to the families of spacetimes with these asymptotic conditions, then we're not looking at all possible configurations and so on and so forth. We're just studying what is happening in that subfamily. And in that subfamily, it turns out that the offending term actually can be reabsorbed into our charge because it gives us it's exact. So this means, of course, it can be reabsorbed. In the charge. So in, for once I'm on time, and so just the last, the teaser for tomorrow. We will look at black hole spacetime and so this is the I don't know if we will be able to do all I'm gonna say not tomorrow, on Thursday, but we will start looking at black hole spacetimes and try to understand their properties so that we will be able to study these equations on that particular background in asymptotically flat spacetimes. And the second step will be to apply that type of equation, use the Hamiltonian flow equation in this context in in the field space, in the subset of field space that contains these black holes, and to deduce the following.
Well, let me get my.
An equation that looks like this. An equation that looks like this. So we have, so what's the gist of it? Well, the gist of it is that we know that the energy, so this is now the energy, not the, it's nothing to do with equations of motion, sorry. Maybe I should call it E. So we all know that this is the first law of black hole mechanics. First law of black hole mechanics, which is about energy conservation. So this is the mechanical energy. This is a sort of work term due to angular momentum. And this is the entropy of the black hole. So this will, in particular, tell us that we can deduce this entropy from these neutral charge expressions. So black hole entropy as a neutral charge, which is an idea due to Wald and Ayer, I don't remember the spelling, from the early 90s. So this is, I will try. So that's where what we're after. And here to see that this is not completely far-fetched, so this is the sketch of the idea, is that if these charges actually are represent, you know, in the standard context, we found that the charge for time translation is the energy, or the charge for translations is the momentum, and for rotations is the angular momentum. Oh, so also this is, we do not have enough letters to to work. So these objects. Energy and angular momentum are part, probably naturally part of our Q, of our charges, part of neutral charge associated to time translations and rotations. And so this can be encoded into particular diffeomorphisms of the black hole spacetime, particularly some Killings. So we will have to understand how this equation should be read when we Xi is a Killing vector field. And we will get this surprise term out of the analysis. Essentially, the point is that these charges, this Q, as we said, are not vanish on shell, but they become, unless there are corners, and if there are corners, they localize at the corner. So we have one piece of the surface which is at infinity, one at the horizon. The piece at the horizon will give us the area, which is the entropy. And the piece at infinity will contribute the energy and the angular momentum. So that's a rough idea. OK. Yeah?
In that equation, we are integrating over the corner. But B is a zero form in space-time.
Oh, I is a top form on the corner. So the idea is that here you might want to
It just needs to be a top form on the corner so that you can include. So since you're introducing boundary conditions a priori, you could have some boundary structure, some background structure just at the boundary that allows you to say, oh, things are flat here. Or so in that case, you have some background structure that you keep fixed. That's the meaning of boundary conditions. So in that sense, I prefer to think of it as a corner form rather than a bulk form pulled back on the corner, because it depends on some structure that is kept fixed there. But it's a subtlety in a sense. Yeah?
Can you explain why the contraction of the asymplectic form with C is not zero only when psi is transferred?
Oh, the reasoning is just is completely similar to this one. Now you are, in that case, if you look at theta, it will depend on, so I xi theta will be something, will be in particular theta a, epsilon a, sorry, I xi epsilon a. So this is theta a xi b epsilon a b. And now this epsilon AB is, when I pull it back to the pull back to partial sigma, it gives me the volume element on the boundary, so the square root of the induced metric, times not the normal, but the binormal. And this binormal has components in the two normal directions of, and so it must be contracted with xi, and the only way for it not to vanish is to have components in those two directions. But in coordinates, it's just the same thing that is happening here. You can say the corner is at x naught equal 13 and radius equal 7, and you do the same reasoning and you find this. Okay. Very good. See you this afternoon.